From KCRW, this is Left, Right, and Center.
This is Josh Barrow, and you're listening to All the President's Lawyers, a special series from Left, Right, and Center. I'm joined, as always, by Ken White for our weekly exploration of Donald Trump's sprawling legal issues. A little more sprawling than usual this week, Ken.
Very much so.
Ken is a criminal defense attorney in Los Angeles and was formerly a federal prosecutor. He blogs about the law at popehat.com and hosts the First Amendment podcast, Make No Law. So usually when we tape this show, I'm in a studio in New York and Ken is in another studio in L.A., but this week I'm out in L.A. with Ken in studio together, and that's because on Thursday, Ken is joining me and Anna Marie Cox and Rich Lowry and Kelly Goff for a live Left, Right, and Center show in Santa Monica, and there we will talk about the whole Kavanaugh saga, so we are not going to talk extensively about that today. Ken, I'm going to have you hold most of those thoughts for tomorrow. But we will talk about one aspect of that, which is Mark Judge, an eyewitness to the alleged attempted rape, who some Democrats would like to call to testify in that hearing. And there are some interesting Fifth Amendment issues that could arise around that if he were called, which Republicans do not want to do anyway.
Now, it seems to be developing minute by minute over the last day. So who knows where we'll be by tomorrow?
Yeah, who knows, dear listener, what the situation will be when you are listening to this. But first, let's talk about the president's actual lawyers or maybe his missing lawyers. I don't know if you've heard, Ken, President Trump doesn't have an attorney general.
I have no attorney general.
It's very sad, he says. This was his lament to reporters from the conservative Daily Caller. He's still upset that the Justice Department is so impertinent as to convict his associates of crimes, even though he appoints the people who run the Justice Department, who should be grateful and loyal to him, et cetera, et cetera. Is this not the laziest effort to obstruct justice you've ever seen?
It really is. He's just basically lying on the couch grousing. He's clearly very vexed still by Sessions' decision to recuse himself from matters relating to the Russia investigation. He keeps coming back to that with a different set of facts every time. And he clearly, as you said, believes that it's his prerogative to run how the Justice Department does things and to use the loyalty he's won by appointing people to determine how investigations come out, which is not actually a thing.
It's kind of weird. I have not heard about him complaining about Jeffrey Berman, who is the U.S. Attorney for the Southern District of New York, Trump's appointee to be U.S. Attorney for the Southern District of New York. And in fact, there was a mini scandal because before Trump made that appointment, he interviewed Jeffrey Berman personally, which is pretty irregular. Normally, presidents don't conduct direct interviews of the somewhat independent prosecutors they're going to put in charge of these offices. And some of these prosecutions, most notably including the Michael Cohen prosecution, have been conducted by the Southern District of New York. The attorney general is not recused from those. They are not part of Mueller's investigation, though Mueller has had some involvement in them. It's kind of weird. Like, that is arguably the biggest source of trouble for the president right now. His focus yet still seems focused on Sessions and not on Berman, who – why isn't Berman supposed to be loyal to him?
Well, the president hasn't seemed to be overburdened with a detailed knowledge of how the federal criminal justice system actually works. So it could be that he's still focused on thinking that Sessions is his guy who should be stopping things in the Southern District of New York. And it's also the case we've noticed that sometimes there are just odd little gaps in who the president goes after. You know, he doesn't go after, for whatever reason, Avenatti, even though Avenatti is a furious trash talker about him. So it could be that for whatever reason, he doesn't want to be bashing Southern District of New York because he thinks maybe things will start turning around or maybe he's concerned about what they would do. So I don't know. I think what you point out is would certainly be a more consistent approach to this, but I think we've learned not to expect consistency from the president.
There is a report this week in the New York Times about the disarray inside the president's legal team. Maggie Haberman and Michael Schmidt reported it, and here's a quote regarding the president's lawyers. Quote, "The lawyers have only a limited sense of what many witnesses, including senior administration officials and the president's business associates, have told investigators about what the Justice Department plans to do with any incriminating information it has about Mr. Trump, according to interviews with more than a dozen people close to the president. What is more, it is not clear if Mr. Trump has given his lawyers a full account of some key events in which he's been involved as president or during his decades running the Trump Organization." So that's two big issues there. I want to take them separately. One is not knowing what your witnesses told the government, and the other is not knowing what your client really did.
And I think the second one is the more dangerous, more important one. So one of the key jobs of a defense attorney, particularly in complex white-collar type investigations, is to just tear your client down to the ground, to interrogate them about every single detail of the circumstances, to make sure you know all the facts. You know everything that might come out. And this often takes many sessions until they're ready to tell you everything. Just regular people, let alone someone like the president, aren't used to spilling their guts the first time they talk to somebody. And it's disastrous to be running around out there doing things on behalf of a client before you have a high level of confidence that you know everything they know and that you've gotten as much of the truth out of them as possible. Nothing in President Trump's behavior suggests that he has the capacity to sit still for that type of discussion.
Or to be honest in it.
Exactly. Particularly with someone like the president, you need that truth and you need the whole truth. Otherwise, you get what we've been seeing, which is a series of inconsistent statements from different legal representatives that are subsequently contradicted by other witnesses, by the facts, or by the president himself in statements.
So not only have they not gotten a full accounting of the president's behavior, but they seem to have taken him at his word on this claim that he didn't do anything wrong and therefore he had nothing to hide in this investigation. I like this quote from the story that John Dowd explaining to the president why he should basically be cooperative with Mueller and offer people up to interview with him. It says, Dowd explained that he had a special bond with Mr. Mueller because they'd both served in the Marine Corps. And he thought he could get him to end the investigation in a matter of weeks. Mr. Dowd said he thought he might even get the Justice Department to declare that Mr. Trump was not under investigation. All the president had to do, Mr. Dowd said, was cooperate with Mr. Mueller. Mr. Trump, often enticed by promises of speedy and simple fixes to complex problems, embraced Mr. Dowd's thinking. So how f***ing stupid is that? Aren't these people theoretically sophisticated criminal defense lawyers? They've dealt with prosecutors before. They know that, you know, it's not just like, oh, just go in and talk to the man. And I'm sure that if it's a misunderstanding, it'll all just get worked out. I mean, isn't this something that you need to explain to clients all the time? Like, just shut up. Don't think that you can just go in and talk your way out of this.
It is. But it takes a certain amount of intestinal fortitude to do that, particularly when you're presented with a strong personality and with someone that it could be very prestigious and lucrative to represent. So there's a huge amount of pressure for a defense attorney to tell people what they want to hear in order to stay that person's lawyer. You've got to be, if you want to be a good defense attorney, ready to get fired in any given moment, and you frequently are. So the telling people like the president what they want to hear is a constant problem with high-profile white-collar cases, and it's why a lot of people get convicted. I mean, you look back as far as something like a Martha Stewart-type scenario, where that's absolutely a scenario where you see a failure of the attorney to be willing to tell people what they don't want to hear and to be really strong with a strong personality.
Wait, I'm sorry. What was the error with Martha Stewart? What was she not told that she needed to be told?
Don't go in and talk to the government. You think you can talk your way out of this, but you can't. You're going to talk your way into a jail cell. And yeah, absolutely. If that is an accurate rendition of Dowd's advice to the president, it's hideously bad advice.
But wait, here's the thing, because we know that Dowd was sophisticated about that in certain other ways. I mean, this is a thing that came out in the Woodward Fear book, is basically why Dowd fought so hard to prevent President Trump from personally giving an interview, and that he thought that the president would be dishonest. The Fear book even claims that he said this to Robert Mueller, that the president wouldn't be able to get through an interview without lying. So he understood that was too much of a risk. And yet he was willing to naively believe the idea that there were no bad facts lying around, so that it was okay for other people to go and talk with Mueller because that would not reveal bad behavior by the president, because there was no bad behavior. The only risk was that the president would say something wrong. That seems like a ridiculously naive view of the situation for him to have held.
It is a very naive view, but I think you have to look at, we're getting different stories about this from different perspectives. Maybe not all of them are 100% accurate. Also, it could be that his view of things matured over the course of the representation. And finally, again, I mean, you've got a situation where the guy's representing the president of the United States. It's, you know, the plum job. He wants to keep it. That can be just gigantic pressure to tell the client a little bit what he wants to hear. And there's sometimes, honestly, a certain amount of mildly spiteful, fine, to have it your way.
It's your funeral.
Exactly. It's okay, this is what you want to do? Fine. I'm all in. Let's do this thing. Let's see how it turns out. And that's the attitude sometimes that lawyers will take. You know, you feel that you've given the best advice you can. You've made your case. The client still wants to do something else. The client's the captain of the ship. The client gets to decide to stick their neck in the noose if that's what they want to do.
Let's talk about the president's specific problem this week. That obviously, what's gone on with his legal team over the last year plus is his big picture problem. This week, Paul Manafort has entered into an extensive cooperation agreement with the government. Extensive. This thing's like 75 pages, including the exhibits. What did you make reading this agreement?
Well, the agreement, the letter agreement that spells out the terms of the deal, isn't that unusual. What's unusual is the information that he admitted to. So an information is a charging instrument. It's what you plead to, usually in a white-collar case, when you want to waive the right to be charged by a grand jury and admit to some set of facts. And what's remarkable about this thing that he admitted to is, like you said, how long it is and that it had exhibits. I mean, I've been doing this for 25 years, and I've never seen an information with exhibits, and neither have any of the federal criminal practitioners I talked to. So he admitted to this incredibly elaborate set of facts of the things he did wrong and how they were significant, that attached emails and documents proving how significant they were. And it seems calculated not to supply a factual basis for the plea, which is easy and straightforward. It seems calculated really as a public relations move to make pardoning him unacceptably politically costly, and also just to refute any argument that this is all a witch hunt, this is nonsense, this is stuff that other people don't get prosecuted for, this is old minor things, that type of thing.
And so the information, even though this is a plea agreement with regard to, remember, there are two criminal trials of Paul Manafort, one that happened and one that was supposed to be about to happen. The trial that happened was about tax and bank fraud, and he was convicted on eight of those counts. There was going to be a trial on unregistered foreign lobbying. And so this is a plea that is theoretically just about the unregistered foreign lobbying, but the information encompasses both of those things and the ways that they interact with each other, because basically he made a bunch of money from the unregistered foreign lobbying, and then he engaged in a scheme to conceal that money from the U.S. government and to defraud banks about how much money he had.
Right. So he already had the after-trial conviction in Virginia, and he was coming up against this trial in D.C. over the foreign agent lobbying and the obstruction of justice by trying to tamper with witnesses. This plea in D.C. is a roadmap not only for what he pleads to in D.C., but for how he wraps up the remaining charges in Virginia, the ones that the jury hung on. And it's a roadmap for what he's likely facing in terms of a sentence, which is quite dramatic, particularly for someone who's pleading guilty.
Right. So there's an interesting thing here where they agree that he'll be sentenced to no more than 10 years on the Washington, D.C. charges. Those are the unregistered foreign lobbying charges. But then I guess he could be sentenced to as much as 20 years on the charges related to tax and bank fraud. And then how would that work? That time would run at the same time?
So it's all extremely complicated. Imagine filling out a tax return for a large business, and you get a sense of the complexity of figuring out a sentence like this. So in D.C., in that plea, the way they limited his exposure is by letting him plead to only two counts, to only two federal crimes that have combined a maximum sentence of 10 years. Now, when federal judges sentence somebody, they look to something called the federal sentencing guidelines. They're not bound by them, but they tend to stay somewhat close to them, and they tend to use them as a starting point. So everyone's agreeing that the federal sentencing guidelines for the series of crimes is up around 17 to 20 years. So in D.C., he's protected by the fact he only pled to 10 years worth of crimes.
So that's interesting. You can have a situation where the guideline sentence exceeds the maximum allowable sentence. And so obviously they can only sentence you to that maximum, but it must make it really hard to convince them that you should be sentenced to less than the legal maximum, given that the guideline says you should be sentenced even more than that.
Exactly. And so in Virginia, he got convicted of a bunch of counts. So the sky is the limit there for the statutory maximum. And if, as the agreement suggests, the sentencing guidelines are going to be similar in Virginia, then he's looking there at a sentence starting out in a recommended range of the 17 to 20 years in there. In terms of the two sentences and how they work, there's a complicated set of rules about when there are two sentences in two different places, whether they go concurrently or consecutively. In other words, whether they run at the same time and you're sitting in jail and both sentences are running, or whether you have to serve one and the other. And what the government said is that they would agree to recommend to the judge that to the extent the two sentences were about the same things, the same subjects, they would run concurrently. They would go at the same time. But Paul Manafort still has a very large sentence to work off. I mean, he's a man who's pushing 70. He's looking at a guideline sentence, which is really where the judges are going to start, that's up in that 17 to 20-year range. He's going to have to do some pretty spectacular cooperation to have a firm sense that he's going to get out of jail.
So what might that entail?
You know, it's really speculation at this point. I think you can see how for months and months and months, everyone's been saying that Manafort's the guy who knows where all the bodies are buried. Manafort's the one who can give up the president and all this. You don't see a lot of signs of that in this plea agreement or in the information. There's nothing in the information where they lock him in to some sort of statement about what the president did or knew, or even what other senior members of the campaign or administration said or did. That doesn't mean he doesn't know. But it would be fairly common for the prosecutor, if they had that big fish they were looking for, to lock in a cooperator at the time of their plea. So, for instance, in the case of Michael Cohen, the former attorney for the president, technically, who entered his guilty plea a few weeks ago that we talked about, they locked him in his statement, in his plea, to incriminating other people, through pseudonyms in the campaign and in American media. So that was a sign that those people might be further targets. Here, although you see some incrimination of some other people acting as foreign agents, you don't get a big sense of some big fish that they're locking him in.
Well, I don't know about that, because I think some of these people he collaborated with are arguably big fish in their own right. Because this is something that I see a lot of in this information, is descriptions of the other entities and people that he collaborated with in a scheme to conduct unregistered foreign lobbying. And these are big deal names that places like, I mean, they're called Company A and Company B in the information, but this is Mercury Public Affairs, which is a very big deal Republican lobbying firm, and the Podesta Group, which was a very big deal Democratic lobbying firm and has basically been bankrupted by this episode. So conceivably, couldn't those be the sorts of people that he would provide testimony about and demonstrate that a lot of other people were also engaged in high-dollar unregistered foreign lobbying, and they could go ahead and prosecute those people?
They could. And I think in a normal year, those would be big fish. But I'm not sure that they're 2018 big fish. And I think the expectation that we've been hearing about relentlessly was that Manafort presents a danger to Trump or people in the close Trump orbit, like his kids or senior advisors. And all I'm saying is I don't see direct proof of that in this plea.
Mid last week, before this plea was filed, Rudy Giuliani claimed that Trump still had a joint defense agreement in place with Paul Manafort. Is that plausible, given that Manafort must have been deep in negotiations over this plea agreement at that point?
Oh, God, that's wrong on so many levels. I mean, first of all, joint defense agreements always have terms in them that says the first rule of joint defense agreements is you can't talk about the joint defense agreements, even if you're Rudy Giuliani. There is no Rudy Giuliani exception. Second of all, joint defense agreements always have terms describing what you have to do if you start cooperating with the government. So Manafort would have had to, through his lawyers, give notice of withdrawal from the joint defense agreement at some point during the negotiations. And, if he doesn't, it just complicates things and makes the government's case potentially trickier. So first of all, Giuliani shouldn't have said it. And second of all, I seriously doubt it was accurate at the time he said it. I suspect that he knew by then, or should have known, that Manafort was already withdrawing from any agreement.
Let's take a quick break. And then when we come back, we'll talk about Michael Flynn and Mark Judge. This is All the President's Lawyers. We're back. Back in December, former National Security Advisor Michael Flynn pleaded guilty to one count of lying to the FBI. And every few weeks since then, there's been a filing to say Mueller was not yet ready for Flynn to be sentenced, presumably because Flynn's cooperation with the government was still ongoing. They didn't know how valuable it was, and they didn't know what he ought to be sentenced to. Well, not anymore. Mueller now says he's ready for Flynn to get his sentence, and they're looking toward a sentencing date in November. Ken, what does that mean for the overall investigation?
What it means is that Mueller has decided he's gotten out of Flynn what he can reasonably get out of him. So generally, you keep continuing a cooperator's sentencing date to keep the pressure on them and, you know, keep the hook in them for as long as you think they might be useful, that they might potentially testify against somebody, help you with information, anything like that. So the fact that Mueller is now ready for Flynn to be sentenced suggests that Flynn is not going to be the guy who takes down Trump. Flynn's not going to be the guy who testifies in some big trial, that they're basically done with him.
So this means that there's not a secret plan for Mueller to let Flynn withdraw his guilty plea and that there's not going to be some grand apology to Michael Flynn for railroading him when he was an innocent and honorable man who didn't actually do anything wrong, because that's what they've been saying on like 12chan.
Yeah, I know. And a lot of Twitter law has been very strongly advocating that position. But no, all that's always been nonsense. And it doesn't make a whole lot of difference for someone like Flynn, who is looking at a very short amount of time in terms of exposure. You know, it's a plea to a false statement to the FBI.
Do you think he's going to get prison time at all?
It could go either way, but not much if he does. You know, we saw a 14-day sentence just the other week.
I think George Papadopoulos.
Exactly. I think something like that is possibly in the cards. But, you know, I think the reasonable expectation is anything from straight probation to a couple of months in custody. Much more than that would surprise me.
This is a lot of criminal law for one week. Let's talk about speech. You may recall some of the irresponsible remarks the president made when there were protesters at his rallies. Here he is, for example, at a rally in Cedar Rapids, Iowa in February 2016.
So if you see somebody getting ready to throw a tomato, knock the crap out of them, would you? Seriously. Okay? Just knock the hell. I promise you, I will pay for the legal fees. I promise. I promise.
Now, he wasn't always quite this explicit. There were protesters at a different rally in Kentucky. They brought suit against the president, saying he incited violence against them after he said this.
All right, get him out. Get him out. Get him out. Get him out.
So those protesters, they brought suit claiming the president had engaged in incitement. They just lost on appeal before the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals. The court said the president's comments were not incitement under Kentucky law. Ken, what was their analysis?
Well, this was a situation where the protesters had sued for, among other things, violation of Kentucky incitement to riot law. And the trial court was going to let the case go forward against the president, but because of the significance of the issue, allowed an immediate appeal. And what the court said was that you have to, first of all, look at what the statute requires. And the statute requires urging people to do violence, basically. And the court decided just saying get them out of there was not an explicit and clear enough call for violence. And secondarily, the court also looked at the First Amendment issues. So generally, you can't punish speech on the theory that it's incitement unless it passes a constitutional test for incitement from a case called Brandenburg. And the Brandenburg test is basically, is this speech intended and likely to cause imminent lawless action? And so just, you know, trash-talking people, talking about the wisdom or necessity of action, anything like that, is not going to be enough. You have to have a situation where someone is fairly clearly calling for imminent lawlessness and it's likely to have that effect. And the court said that wasn't the case here, that get them out there was not sufficiently clear a call for imminent violence, despite the fact that there was violence. So what the court said is you can't have a Monday morning quarterback approach with the First Amendment. The fact that someone did react that way doesn't mean that in the first instance it was a call for violence.
What if there had been violence in the immediate aftermath of one of these more explicit things the president said, like, you know, knock the crap out of them, would you? Seriously, okay, knock the hell, I promise you I will pay for the legal fees. That seems fair, like a fairly explicit incitement. Right?
I think that crosses the line. And honestly, I think this one, get them out of here, is not a crystal clear case. I think it could have gone the other way. I think in context, get them out of here is directed at the crowd, is directed to getting them to take action against the protesters. the implication is that they're going to do it by force. So it's not an easy call. But the one you're talking about, some of the other statements the president made, I think are a lot closer to actual incitement.
And this is purely a civil matter, or could the president theoretically be criminally charged over something like this?
Well, this case is purely civil. Prosecutors can do whatever they're going to do, but I think it's highly unlikely on those facts. And plus, then you've got the issue of whether or not a sitting president can be charged with the crime, with the prevailing view being no.
Finally, let's talk about Mark Judge. This is the schoolmate of Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh. California professor Christine Blasey Ford alleges Kavanaugh drunkenly attempted to rape her when he was 17 years old at a party, and the judge was a witness to this. Judge has submitted a letter to the Judiciary Committee saying he doesn't remember any incident like this. Judge has previously written a memoir about his problem drinking in his high school days. He also says he never saw Kavanaugh behave like this. Republicans and Democrats have been fighting over whether to call Judge to testify as a part of hearings that may happen next week looking into this incident. Democrats say it's important to hear from him under oath, but Republican Senator Jeff Flake says he doesn't know whose witness Judge would be. Judge, for his part, says he does not want to testify. Ken, Maryland has no statute of limitations for felony sex offenses, so now I'm not imagining that this case would be a viable criminal prosecution at this point. But doesn't the theoretical possibility of such a prosecution create an opportunity for Judge to take the Fifth Amendment if he were to be called to testify? Because Blasey's account has Judge being somewhat involved in the alleged assault, shouting things like, go for it, jumping on top of Blasey and Kavanaugh. Couldn't he contend that he has some potential criminal liability here and therefore can't be compelled to testify?
Yes, for two reasons. First of all, because it does appear there's no statute of limitations on this crime in the state where this allegedly took place. So answering questions could incriminate him. And bear in mind that for the Fifth Amendment, incriminating yourself doesn't just mean like confessing. It means providing any information that could be one link in the chain prosecutors need to prosecute you. But for a very practical reason, I think he could take the Fifth Amendment, and that's the fact that the process for challenging or testing his decision to do so is very protracted and difficult and is unlikely to compel him in the time frame we're talking about here. So it's tough to compel someone over their Fifth Amendment objection to testify. It causes all sorts of difficult problems. Judges are somewhat reluctant to do it. They're particularly reluctant when it comes to testifying in front of Congress because of the specter of how badly that's gone in the past with people like Oliver North, who you might remember. He was compelled to testify, and that wound up overturning his criminal conviction.
This was in the Iran-Contra scandal.
Right. So practically speaking, even if the assertion of the Fifth Amendment would be, you know, insubstantial, I think it's extremely unlikely that Congress would be able to compel him over that Fifth Amendment assertion to testify. So practically speaking, I think he can do it.
And so this, I think, is probably a reason Republicans have been so reluctant to call Mark Judge to testify. They're willing to have Blasey testify. They're willing to have Kavanaugh testify about this. But suppose they said, OK, you're right. Judge's testimony is important. Let's call him. So then you call Judge. Judge refuses to testify. You have to start this process to compel him to testify under the Fifth Amendment. That is going to take, what, months, presumably? Weeks, right, at least?
And plus, just the specter of someone who was allegedly at the party and a friend of Kavanaugh taking the Fifth as
right
to what happened is a, you know, a spectacle that I think looks very bad for them. Not to mention the fact that Judge has said and written a lot of somewhat skeevy things that I think would make for very ripe examination by the Democrats on the committee that would kind of dirty Kavanaugh up by association.
Could Congress immunize him from the use of that testimony in a prosecution against him? I know they can do that for federal prosecutions. Would that be a way to get around the Fifth Amendment issue?
That's one way, is to give immunity. And it's not clear that they can immunize him from state prosecution, but it would be a huge difficulty in prosecuting him. But let's face it, there's effectively no chance that Maryland prosecutors are going to ever prosecute for something described like this. So it's all angels on the head of a pin. But there are a number of ways that they could try to compel him to speak over the Fifth Amendment assertion. All of those are difficult and take time.
There is so much more to talk about, including a lot more on this Kavanaugh issue. Ken White will be joining me and Anna Marie Cox and Rich Lowry and Kelly Goff and some other special guests on a special live Left, Right, and Center episode, which we will tape on Thursday evening in Santa Monica, California, and which will be distributed to all of you podcast listeners on Friday, if you are subscribed to Left, Right, and Center, which you should be. We will also be talking about the changing politics of the American suburb. We're looking at a lot of these battleground districts in the 2018 congressional elections. We're going to have a couple of experts from Orange County to talk about that county, which went for a Democratic presidential candidate in 2016 for the first time in 80 years. You have four congressional districts being hotly contested in that county, and it's sort of an example for districts outside Minneapolis and Chicago and Atlanta and other ancestrally Republican areas that are newly competitive because of people who really have a problem with Donald Trump. So make sure to listen to that episode. Make sure you're subscribed to Left, Right, and Center on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get podcasts. And if there's something you've been wondering about the president, the porn star, and all the president's lawyers, send us your questions. You can find us on Twitter at LRCKCRW and on Facebook, too. This program is produced by Sarah Fay. I'm Josh Barrow. Thanks for joining us, and I'll be back later this week with Left, Right, and Center.
Download and subscribe at kcrw.com/LRC, the KCRW app, or wherever you find podcasts. Left, Right, and Center is produced and distributed by KCRW.